Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on The Conversation. It is Monday, June 3rd. It's also day three of the venting of fumes from the military's massive underground fuel tanks at Red Hill. We get an update. Efforts to get aid into Gaza using a U.S.-built floating dock remain suspended due to damage from bad weather. We hear from a Molokai resident who flew halfway across the world to try to help bring supplies to families in Palestine on a failed flotilla of boats, dubbed the Freedom Flotilla. With Kilauea stirring once again, we look at new research into the 2018 eruption. What does it tell us? And the widow of famed author Michael Crichton publishes a new book about Mauna Loa. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today marks the third day of venting fumes from the massive underground fuel tanks at Red Hill. And so far, so good. The military calls it the degassing of some 16 tanks that have been drained of jet fuel and diesel. The operation started Thursday afternoon and will take place Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. Joanna Delphin is the Deputy Public Affairs Officer for Closure Task Force Red Hill. She spoke with us earlier today about how the operation is progressing.
So it's a forced air ventilation system where the Navy is using fans and ductwork that's installed at the lower tunnel and then at the upper access tunnel. So the lower tunnel fan blows air into the tank at the bottom and circulates that clean air throughout the tank. And then the upper tunnel fan sucks the air out of it and then exits through what is called an adit or adit 4 at the facility. And the process takes approximately 3 to 6 weeks to ensure the tank is safe for workers to enter so they can start actually cleaning the entire tank. And, you know, this method has been used during previous cleaning, inspection, and repair projects of the underground storage tanks without incident. So every single time the Navy had to go in and clean the tank or inspect the tank, there's always been ventilation operations to ensure the safety of the workers who are entering the tanks. So with ventilation, it's a three-phase process.
Let me halt you right here. So to give people a kind of a bird's eye view, so there are a total of 20 tanks. Four have already been cleaned.
So this
process is nothing new. You've done it before. It's just that we've never really done like 16 all at once.
Correct. It's been done before. However, we're not doing 16 all at once. The original plan was to do 2 tanks at a time. But what we're doing right now currently is we're staggering it, right? So we started venting tank 8 at the facility. And, you know, in the next few days, we'll likely start ventilating another tank. So the ventilation for each tank will be staggered at every point. So we're not doing 16 tanks at once, nor are we doing 2 tanks at once. We're doing it in a staggered phase. So one started on Thursday, and then we'll likely start another one in the coming days.
Okay. And so you're still working on tank 8?
Correct.
And are there any other special precautions that you're taking for the workers that you weren't, you know, doing before in the previous degassing of the other 4 tanks?
I can tell you that for the Navy Closure Task Force's operations for tank cleaning, you know, ventilation is the first part of it, right? We need to make sure that the air inside the tanks are safe for the workers going inside it. So measuring the levels inside the tank, you know, the workers will be donning proper protective equipment, so PPEs whenever they enter the tanks to do the cleaning. So it's nothing new. Everything that we're doing has been done in the past. The Navy has done it in the past. I will say, however, one thing that we're doing that is new is air quality monitoring. So we have 9 air quality monitoring stations that are situated around the perimeter of Red Hill to monitor the levels, the air levels, and the air quality around the perimeter, as well as weather data so that we can monitor wind direction, temperature, all that stuff.
And then I know that you did put a monitor in near the Halaba Correctional Center because of the special, you know, needs in the population there.
Yeah, we did. The data that they provide also includes wind direction and temperature. So that data will let us know if at any point the winds are favoring to a specific direction and if there's any precautionary measures that need to be taken. But thus far, the winds thankfully have been working out very well for us. We haven't had any spikes in our air monitoring since we started operations, but our team did meet with the Halava Correctional Facility, I believe it was a couple of weeks ago, to kind of outline to them what our plan looks like. So, it's been great working with, the team over there at the correctional facility. And we actually, like you said, we have a monitor set up in that area as well.
And then you did have a walkthrough with the Hawaii Emergency Management officials prior to starting this?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So we did the walkthrough last week with the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency and the Environmental Protection Agency.
Okay. Any additional recommendations that they made following that?
I can't say. I would have to talk to one of our subject matter experts if there was anything additional that came out of that.
Anything else that you think the public should know? I mean, just to be, I guess, aware that you're doing this. So if they, feel something's amiss, they can call either the health department, the EPA, or 911 if they feel there's a threat?
So right now, we are reporting near real-time data on our NCTF Red Hill app. So if you go to your Google Play Store or your Apple Store, you just search NCTF-RH, and you can download that app. And during ventilation operations, which is Monday through Friday, 6 in the morning to 8 in the evening, we'll be posting near real-time data via the app. So if you log in there right now, you can see that we started posting data when ventilation operations started on Thursday. And in addition to the app, we have been posting daily data to our website, which is NavyClosureTaskForce.navy.mil. And on the website, it'll provide you the previous day's data if you go onto that ventilation air quality monitoring slide. And then for any, residents or the community who may have concerns about ventilation or air quality monitoring, they can call our Navy call center. The number is 808-210-6968.
Can you give us some sense as to how long this process might take and when you might finish the two tanks?
So the tanks, I believe, should take anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. We want to take every precautionary measure to ensure the safety and welfare of the workers going into the tank. So right now it averages between anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks. So it's about that average. I don't think we can pinpoint exactly how long each tank will take. We want to make sure that, the environment is safe for the individuals going to actually conduct the tank cleaning operation.
Okay, and that's when the sludge removal will happen?
So there's two different types of sludge removal. So the first is what we call flowable sludge, or basically sludge that can float, right? So we'll go ahead and we'll put water into the tank, and that floatable sludge will exit through what's called a fuel oil reclamation line. And that's like the flowable sludge, right? So we can remove it that way. And then once we remove all of that sludge that floats on top, once that's all drained out and ventilation is complete, then we'll have actual workers going into the tank and, shoveling out what is remaining of the sludge.
Okay. And then the tanks will be washed down after that?
Correct. It kind of works in phases, right? So we vent the tanks and then we clean it. And then once we clean it, there'll be an inspection period. And then we can move on to, the next iteration.
Oh, I see.
Will.
So it's not like you're degassing all 16 and then?
No.
Okay. So you degas, remove the sludge, you clean, and then you move on to the next two.
Yes.
I see. Okay. All right. Well, that's helpful. That's helpful. Yeah, because, I guess the concern is, because we did have a number of people call 911 when they did have those heavy fumes of fuel when there was the leak back in 2021. Mm-hmm. That was certainly a cause for concern.
Yeah,
but
you folks
are just trying to do it slow and safe.
Yes. And, if at any point anyone, for any reason, has any health concerns or if they smell something or they feel sick, should always, contact 911 or contact their primary physician if they have any health concerns.
That was Navy spokeswoman Joanna Delphin giving us a snapshot of how the venting of the fumes from the underground fuel tanks is going. The Navy Closure Task Force Red Hill began degassing tank number 8 on Thursday afternoon after going through a checklist of the protocols. There are some 9 air monitors set up in the neighboring communities, including the Halaba Correctional Facility, where some 600 inmates are housed. We will have links to the Navy's fact sheet on our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's backyard quiz, we look to early 20th century Kaka'ako. The area was known as Kiwalo, and the natural wetlands were being filled and urbanized. As development grew, so did the need for public facilities. In 1909, Hawaii Territorial Governor Walter Freer passed a law to establish a public library. The site he chose on Punchbowl and King Streets was already occupied by a school for girls. From the 1880s to the 1910s, the school served the illegitimate offspring of Hawaiian women and foreign men. The facility eventually relocated to Kaka'ako, where it reopened in 1913. Through the years, the school changed its focus to special education, and before eventually closing in 1980. Our quiz question, can you name the school that once stood on the grounds of the main library branch? Hint, there's a Kaka'ako Street with the same name. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
The Freedom Flotilla that aimed to break the Israeli harbor blockade into Gaza to get food and other supplies into the hands of Palestinian families failed to set sail from Turkey back in April. The grassroots coalition included 2 Hawaii residents and peace activists, former Army Colonel Ann Wright, who we talked to in Turkey back in April, and Molokai resident Jason Mizula. HPR's Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel connected with Mizula when he returned home to the Friendly Isle. She joins us live. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so I wondered when I heard that a Molokai resident was over there, what motivated him?
Yeah, so he lives on Molokai with his wife and 2 young sons under the age of 2. And, you know, it's incredible to think about leaving behind his family to risk his life, really, on this mission. He is just a very caring and empathetic person. He is a military veteran, spent 6 years in the military, deployed to Iraq. And after he returned and left the military, he went to college in Boston, and one of his best friends was a Palestinian woman, and a group of their really close friends traveled to Palestine in 2011. And he made lasting friends there, and he and his wife, Bahar, sell Palestinian fair trade organic olive oil at local farmers markets on Molokai to raise money to help farmers in Palestine grow more olive trees. So he has a lot of personal connections there, and he knew and write through Veterans for Peace, Hawaii organization that he's involved with. As you mentioned, she's a retired colonel in the Army and also a former diplomat. So she was one of the organizers of this mission. And as you said, Jason and Ann were the only two from Hawaii on the International Freedom Flotilla. And he flew from Honolulu to Italy, where they were gathering and, you know, figuring out all of the logistics involved in this. A lot of moving parts. He then flew to Istanbul, and he was gone for about a month. And, you know, he said that his motivation behind doing this was that he just cares about people as much as he does his own family. You know, when others are suffering, when he sees, you know, unfortunate things happening around the globe, he feels it really deeply and personally. And his wife, Bahara, says that his level of empathy and compassion is really untouched, that he will always stand up for the oppressed, and his compassion for humanity is part of his courage, is how she described it, even if it means risking his own life. She said that there was really no question that he would go on this mission. And here Jason talks about the preparation involved for those who were selected for the flotilla.
They did a lot to prepare for this, and there was very intense nonviolence training, to the point that even if commandos were dropping down from helicopters, like, they can do what they're going to do, and like we're not going to do anything. And that was just mentally to prepare for that. And I was ready, because I know that that's not going to help the people of Gaza, that's not going to help the people on the boat. And there were folks that in that moment during the training that maybe did get a little elevated, and they were pulled aside, and one person was basically removed from the mission just because they're not going to take any risks. And we had to make an SOS video, because in every time that the flotilla has been stopped by the Israeli military, it's been in well within international waters, like well beyond the 25 nautical miles. I think one of the times it was over 100. Basically, the ship is hijacked, taken over by the Israeli commandos, and then taken back to one of the ports in Israel. So we had to make SOS videos that would be released by the media team, almost 50 countries involved, so if that were to happen. And then also I made a video, a lot of the folks make videos that I was going, the day we set sail, I was going to email to Bahar's father, because it really it's heartbreaking to even think that just literally we were just trying to deliver food and medicine to people. And I made a video like apologizing to Bahar and the boys for why I didn't make it home.
Wow. You know, you hear his child there in the background. Yeah, risking his life. It's a tough one.
It is, for sure. And luckily, you know, he said he didn't have to use those videos. He did return home safely after, you know, unfortunately the mission failed. And he since deleted the videos. But, you know, thinking about making those videos to share with your family in that unfortunate event is really heavy. Here is his wife, Bahar, talking about the experience from her perspective at home.
This is our sacrifice. This is my sacrifice. It was physically and emotionally very difficult just taking care of the babies. I'm really fortunate. My parents live on island, and they were a huge support system for me emotionally and physically with the kids, just helping out. But it was one of the hardest months of my life, just, you know, in terms of doing the work here to ensure that he could do the work there. But again, that the difficulty of my life and what we're going through is just nothing compares to what people are going through in Gaza. So in a way, again, when we say we're going to be okay, that's the truth. We're going to make it out. We are sacrificing our time and our energy and potentially, you know, Jason really risking his life. But that's our sacrifice that we have to do. We have to stand up in every way we can to for the better of humanity and for the people that are really suffering.
You know, and friends and family, you know, of those two Hawaii residents, you know, worried, you know, for their safety. I remember shortly after talking to Ann Wright you know, she said this was not a suicide mission. You know, they wanted to be safe. But then Iran started to send those drones over to Israel. So, yeah, very tense moments.
For sure. And within 24 hours of when they were supposed to sail, Jason says they got news that Guinea-Bissau revoked the flag on the ship that they were supposed to sail on. So it's common in international shipping, I learned, that ships are registered to a country that's not necessarily their home port. And in this case, they happened to be using a ship that belonged to Guinea-Bissau that had diplomatic relations with Israel. And so at the last minute, that country decided that, hey, you know, we don't want this ship going in. And so it basically derailed the whole mission. It takes a lot of time to organize a new ship, et cetera, et cetera. And that was really hard news for them. You know, they had gone through all of this training, all of the buildup, all of the preparation, gathering, you know, over 5,000 tons of food. And to not have that be able to move forward was really hard. Jason was devastated that it couldn't move forward.
5,500 tons of aid is better than nothing. And even if we could have just provided like a couple meals and like shown a little bit of compassion and we could have just hugged some of the people, like let the folks in Gaza know that they're not alone and that they're not abandoned, that the world does care. Like 50 countries. I mean, there's people from literally like every corner of the world. And to make the video, just to go through the entire process and to not even really get the chance, because there was a chance that once we set sail that we would be stopped. But we also felt that like maybe it didn't hurt our chances of safely making it because we had Nelson Mandela's grandson with us. And there's literally like a boat full of doctors and surgeons and human rights attorneys.
Yeah, what an experience. And I'm just curious, though, do we know whatever happened to all the aid that was on all those boats?
Yeah, so he said the food, you know, is non-perishable. It has a life of 3 years or so. And it was offloaded from the ship onto trucks. And he said it's now sitting in basically a line in Egypt of vehicles loaded up with aid. And they're just hoping that it will be able to cross the border, you know, at some point soon. And they are planning a future flotilla under a more stable flag. He says he doesn't know if he will be on that mission, but it is in the works. And maybe we'll hear more about that in the future soon.
Yeah, I know it's a concern just because the floating dock that the U.S. built is has been paused because of bad weather. So, yeah, it's a difficult situation. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Kluwe-Pachtel, who interviewed Molokai's Jason Mezulla about his attempt to help get supplies into the hands of Palestinian families in need.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
We live in an on-demand world, and HPR is here for you wherever and whenever you want to listen. Get the best of our local talk shows in podcast form. You can have The Conversation, Bite Marks Cafe, The Body Show, and more. Delivered right to your phone or device as soon as they're released. Plus, subscribe to features like Manu Minute and Off the Road with Dave Lawrence. For the full list, just head to our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak, host of The Body Show. Each week, we do our best to provide you with up-to-date medical information from our local experts that might help you or someone you love know more about the world of medicine. Join us today for our latest episode at 6:30 right here on The Body Show.
Support for HPR comes from Ala Moana Hotel by Mantra, offering guests rooms and suites with ocean, mountain, and city views, and a lobby reflecting a blend of Hawaii's tropical colors. Reservations at alamoanahotel.com.
Today, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory announced that Kilauea is erupting again. The eruption began in the early morning hours, about a mile south of the volcano's caldera. Coincidentally, a new study just came out that could potentially shed light into how this volcano erupts with an eye toward better forecasting in the future. Josh Crozier studied the 2018 explosive volcanic eruptions at Kilauea. He found that they didn't follow the normal rules for volcanoes, and he proposed a new mechanism to explain the eruptions. Think of a child's stomp rocket toy, where stepping on a platform causes a hollow rocket to shoot up in the air. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Crozier about his new research.
I was on site about a month before this eruptive sequence started. In 2018, I was a PhD student, and I had been working on other types of seismic signals at Kilauea. And it was clear early on that something quite important was happening, both from a hazards perspective and a science perspective at the volcanoes.
I think to talk about what this study is adding, this kind of new mechanism for volcanic eruptions that you present, I think it's important to go back a bit and talk about how volcanoes typically erupt. Traditionally, yeah. When we think of an eruption, what do we think of?
So I think probably the explosive volcanic eruption mechanism that most people might be most used to thinking about is what we would just call a magmatic eruption, in which magma, which is a mixture of molten rock with usually crystals and then bubbles of exsolved gas, various species, water, CO2, is ascending through the Earth's crust. And as it ascends, it exsolves more gas. That gas expands. And there's kind of a feedback where at some point, ascending rapidly enough, you fragment that mixture into a sort of hot gas and individual ash pyroclasts. And then that mixture is what blasts up, forms an eruption plume. And so there, it's really the ascent of the magma and the gas expansion within that magma that's driving the eruption. At the other end of the spectrum is what we call phreatic or groundwater-driven eruptions, where there's not really fresh magma directly involved, but magma is providing a heat source that it's heating up crustal rocks. And then there's groundwater in those rocks and conditions where that groundwater can flash to steam. That creates a sudden expansion that breaks apart the crustal rocks. And then we have fragments of steam and crustal rock that are blasted up to form an eruption. This is kind of a spectrum, so there can be what we call phreatomagmatic eruptions that are some combination of the two. But yeah, most eruptions are typically thought to be driven either directly by magma ascent or by groundwater.
What were the early clues that maybe the eruptions at Kilauea weren't behaving like either of those?
There's a bit of context here, which is that Kilauea has had explosive eruptions at the summit in the past, most recently in the 1920s. And so what happened then was the lava lake drained from being visible at the surface to dropping hundreds of meters. And the thinking at the time and throughout the decades since really was that lava lake draining allowed groundwater to move in near the summit vent through the rocks that would have previously been kept too hot by the lava lake, and that would have allowed phreatic groundwater-driven explosions to have happened. And so in 2018, in May, the lava lake had drained a lot, and so the scientists at the Hawaii Volcano Observatory were worried that a similar thing could potentially happen again. But there was actually some analysis done that suggested that the rock around the summit should have remained hot for much too long to have allowed kind of a rapid groundwater enrochment. And so we shouldn't really have had phreatic eruptions. And yet, nonetheless, explosions did start occurring. And interestingly, these explosions were highly regular, about once a day. They were associated with very large earthquakes. And importantly, the material that was erupted didn't really appear to be fresh magma. It was largely broken up class of crustal rock or cooled and kind of refragmented lava. And so taking together all of this has kind of pointed towards this what we're calling a stomp rocket mechanism, where each earthquake is a caldera collapse event, where a huge sector of rock above the magma reservoir is kind of suddenly dropping downward, pressurizing a pocket of accumulated gas and debris, and then directly pushing up that gas and debris to make an eruption plume without really fresh magma or groundwater being directly involved.
Kilauea is one of the most monitored volcanoes in the world. So what was it about the amount of data and also the frequency of eruptions here that led you to be able to really test this hypothesis out?
So I think really putting this stomp rocket puzzle together was possible in part because we had multiple types of data. And so we had geophysical instruments, so seismometers and GNSS or GPS stations and tilt meters on the ground, which were telling us that when each of these large earthquakes and explosions happened, most of the ground around the volcano summit was being pushed up and outward, which is what we would expect from, say, a reservoir being suddenly pressurized. However, at the same time, infrasound sensors, which essentially measure very low frequency sounds, were showing that air pressure was dropping at the same time this ground inflation was happening, which is not what you would generally expect. And so that's a clue that some chunk of the ground more centered over the reservoir is actually suddenly dropping downward. And so that's the collapse or the stomp part of this mechanism, which is really creating that reservoir pressure increase. And then finally, we had good atmospheric data. So again, the infrasound data gives us a sense for when the plume is actually arriving at the surface, and radar data scanning the skyline gave us information about exactly how quickly these plumes are ascending and what elevations they reached. So we were able to kind of combine all of that to really put together a comprehensive picture of what was going on underneath and above the ground.
How common might this be?
This 2018 eruption at Kilauea was really the first time this mechanism has been identified and studied. And so we don't really know how widespread it might be, but there are reasons to expect that it's probably not a completely unique thing. For example, caldera collapse eruptions, like what happened at Kilauea in 2018, are actually fairly common. There have been a number around the world just in the past few decades. And so potentially any time you have a scenario where there's some kind of open vent to the atmosphere above a magma reservoir, and then we're creating conditions where collapse might be occurring into that reservoir. And these collapses seem to, whenever we've observed them, often occur as these discrete, relatively large earthquakes. And so we're suddenly pressurizing these reservoirs and creating conditions where this kind of stomp rocket explosive eruption mechanism might be involved. It's certainly worth thinking more when we see these eruptions starting up in the future if this is something we should consider. And for past eruptions, for example, the 1920 explosive eruptions at Kilauea were eruptions that we've observed at other volcanoes.
And so looking forward, now that we know that this is a way that volcanoes can erupt, is there any signs that researchers can now look for?
Certainly trying to move towards making better and better forecasts of when eruptive activity might occur, what eruptive activity might occur, how large that eruptive activity might be. And so I think a really important thing that's come out of this study is that because we have such good data on both the geophysical signals and the atmospheric plumes that were produced, and we can connect those signals, it's potentially provides a good pathway forward for better calibrating how we relate geophysical observations, so say seismic data, to the eruptive plumes that are occurring. Because at many volcanoes, they're not very well monitored, often in remote areas. For example, the Aleutian Park in Alaska has a lot of volcanoes that pose major aviation hazards. But if an eruption happens, usually our initial data is just seismic and infrasound recordings. And so the better we can relate those to what the eruptive plume might be doing, the better we can start making forecasts about what the hazards from those explosive eruptions might be.
And anything else that listeners should know, especially people living on the Big Island?
As with many volcanoes, Kilauea, while capable of causing a lot of devastation, is also quite remarkable in the variety of behavior it's able to exhibit. So we've seen it produce effusive lava flows, explosive magmatic eruptions in its past, and now this kind of new type of eruption mechanism, this dump rocket mechanism, which is sort of a completely different thing to what we've seen before. And so the variety of volcanic activity we see is quite remarkable.
That was Josh Crozier, a postdoctoral researcher at Stanford University. He spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender about the 2018 eruptive sequence at Kilauea. And this was before the news that the volcano is erupting again. Crozier clarified that this current eruption that started just after midnight last night is probably not due to a stomp rocket mechanism, but instead looks more like a magmatic fissure eruption. The Hawaiian Volcano Observatory has a live webcam of the current eruption zone because it's an area not easily accessible to the public. But we'll have a link to it and to Crozier's paper at our website after the show. And now it's time for the Backyard Quiz Answer. Earlier, we explored the history of a Kaka'ako school. It is where Margaret Mother Waldron taught at the facility for 18 years before retiring in 1934. She was known for helping people in the community, and as one story goes, she motivated the neighborhood kids to pick up rocks by posting a photo of Kaiser Wilhelm during World War I. But she also had an honor code. She only helped people who promised her they would pay it forward and do something good for someone else. She died in 1936, and the next year, a park across the street from the school was named in her honor. However, this wasn't the first location of the school. Prior to that, it had been located at King and Punchbowl Streets, the current site of the main branch of the Hawaii State Public Library System. At both locations, it was called Pohu Kindness School. And that's the quiz for today. We had no winners. We stumped you on that one. But if you have an idea for a quiz, write to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
HBR has been recognized with 4 regional Edward R. Murrow Awards, among the most prestigious honors in news. These achievements mark HBR's commitment to excellence in serving our community across the islands and beyond. To listen to these winning stories, visit hawaiipublicradio.org/murrows.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
If you're a fan of the late author Michael Crichton, you may be excited to hear his new novel, Eruption, was released today. Prior to his passing in 2008, Crichton penned nearly 30 novels, 4 of which have been published posthumously. He's best known for writing Jurassic Park, the book the movie franchise is based on. He also wrote and directed the 1970s classic Westworld and created the 90s television series ER. Crichton was a part-time Kauai resident and spent years traveling to Hawaii Island. His new novel is set on the Big Island, where a Mauna Loa eruption threatens a secret weapons cache that could spell the end of the world. The conversation's Russell Subiono got the chance to talk to Crichton's widow, Sherry, about the new book.
You know how Michael always set up these what-if scenarios? Mm-hmm. He was brilliant at it. And he introduced us to things before it really became talking points. He was kind of implanting, you know, gene patenting or cloning or DNA and the possibilities of being able to extract that DNA from a mosquito and you could bring back dinosaurs. Well, here he has set up another what-if scenario, but it is centered around something that is really important to Michael, which is his connection with nature And, you know, he always likes to remind all of us, like, the intensity of nature and yet the fragility of nature. Human interference can be weaponized if it's put into the wrong hands. And that's what's happened here. The concern, obviously, is the volcano. But he has another ticking clock, which is one of those classic Crichton hooks where it's the unexpected. He dives into, well, what if this actually happened? So it's, of course, you know, what's kind of buried beneath the volcano that has been dormant all of these years, kind of forgotten about because nobody needs to know what it doesn't need to know, but now it needs to know. And so there's a lot of twists and turns in the book, a lot of unexpected heroes that come out, and also quite a villainous group of people who think that they know better than the experts. But you get that Crichton science. You know, he had such a love of research. So this particular book, this is going to be hard to believe, Russell, but this particular book, he had been researching for years. And when I say that, it's like, okay, maybe 10 or 15 years. But I mean, over a span of his life. And I just recently, about maybe 2 weeks ago, I was like, I really want Michael's first article because he was published when he was 14 years old in the New York Times. That's a big deal. Let's get that on the walls. I pulled it up offline and I was like, oh my gosh, when I read that first article, it was about a trip to Sunset Crater. It was a family trip. And he said, it clearly says this is not a volcano. But by the end of the article, he dips into the fact of what is a volcano? And then he starts going into the different kinds of lava and the way it, you know, it pushes its way up through the plates. So anyway, it was all of these things. And I'm like, wow, he germinated this story when he was a kid. And that's the importance of me bringing this to life today.
When Mount Elua did erupt just a couple years ago in 2022, after having been dormant for nearly 40 years, what do you think his reaction would have been had it been able to see Mount Elua erupt?
I think it would have been the great anticipation. I think he would have gone right back into his scientific mind. And I have video footage of Michael, I believe it was in the late 70s or early 80s. There is Michael at the top and everything's steaming. I mean, he was walking the walk. He was always spinning stories in his head. But this clearly was, I've got to get in there. I'm not going to read my research out of the library. I actually have to witness it so that when he speaks through his storytelling, he's accurate. And that's the most beautiful thing about Michael. He made it so personal that you just believed him. He danced that line of science fiction to science fact so beautifully and seamlessly that you just believed him. And yet there's a lot of personal attachment to that too. So I think he would have been fascinated. He would probably have wanted to hop on a plane and go see it.
You mentioned Michael's ability to dance between fact and fiction. And I feel like that's one of the things that really set him apart as an author and made his stories so interesting. I know that he received his MD from Harvard Medical School. Do you know if his ability to be able to blend science and character and narrative, was it rooted in that experience?
Well, Michael had this ability to always stay curious. He was always curious. He always wanted to answer questions. He loved people. He was mesmerized by behaviors and psychologically, you know, he just was always curious. His time in medical school, there is no question that was the foundation for clearly the obvious, which is ER. I think a lot of people forget that Michael created ER. Right. And in fact, that character, Carter, played by Noah Wiley, is clearly Michael at, you know, kind of at work. And so I feel like it was the foundation of so much of the way he wrote.
I learned so much from his books as well. After I read Airframe, that's how I learned that airplanes are manufactured separately from engines. You know, that stuck with me all these years. I have a fascination with time travel, so Timeline is probably my favorite book. You mentioned it before. Michael has a connection to Hawaii. I've read that he loved it here. I've heard that he has spent some extended periods of time here. Can you talk about Michael's connection to our island?
Oh my gosh, it made me cry. He loved Hawaii so much. Well, he started going to the Big Island, I think straight out of medical school. He started exploring. Actually, it was back in the early days of Kona Village. That's where he would really take his breaks. He was always in Kona. He was traveling around the world, obviously, but truly his creative juices flowed best in Hawaii. And then he went on to buy a property on the North Shore of Kauai, and that's where we lived, just part-time, not full-time, but extended periods of time. And he loved the beauty of Hawaii. He loved the culture. He loved kind of the newness, yet the old world, but just the way the beautiful Hawaiian chain was formed. The first time he ever introduced me to Hawaii, you know, for me, it was the most fun because it was like I had my own tour guide. Yeah. I felt like I had like stepped into science class. He told me, and I'm so fascinated with it, everything, like the indigenous trees, the ones that aren't supposed to be there, the way that a tree will protect itself and throw out its huge canopy and the undergrowth. He just loved Hawaii. And I go back to the culture. I mean, he used to tell me about stories about, you know, Kamehameha, and, you know, we would visit all the heiaus when you were allowed to do that, which I really appreciate. They're much more protected now because it's amazing to me how, this is going to sound awful, but how some people can be disrespectful in a place that it needs to be so respected. He would tell great stories of the ghost walkers. He believed in all the foundations of your culture and the people. And he would speak pidgin to me all the time and we would laugh. And I mean, we'd laugh at street signs. We would laugh. I mean, it was just such a playground for us. And I swear we hiked every hike there was to hike on Kauai. We were up at those trailheads at 6 o'clock in the morning with our Subway sandwiches in our backpack and ready to go all day.
Four of Michael's books have been published posthumously. I've read Pirate Latitudes, and as a fan of his work, I'm so grateful that we still get the opportunity to live in the worlds that he creates. Was it a difficult decision to allow these previously unfinished stories to be completed? Do you feel like ultimately this is what Michael would have wanted?
Well, I see it this way. I think it's so important that Michael's work, he had such a massive cultural footprint. His works are so timeless, and there's no possible way for him to have had the output when he was alive. I think he left behind these treasures so that we could continue to enjoy him. And you brought it up beautifully, Russell, where you said you learned something from Michael, and I think that's the beauty of him. He was always a teacher. He was curious, but he was always teaching. And this particular piece, I think it's essential that I share his work. I mean, it would be very selfish if I just kept it to myself. I feel like, you know, it'd be like he loved Jasper Johns, he loved Picasso. If there was an unfinished Picasso, guess who would have their hand up in the front row? I would. And so I love being able to use the archive and Michael's brain power to continue to share his work and really to use the archive as a teaching tool. You know, ultimately, I would love to be able to take parts of this so that that's the masterclass for Michael Crichton. Why did he chart? How could that help children? And let's really, you know, kind of leave something for future generations to enjoy. But when you have a piece like this and the amount of research that this embodies, I have to tell you, Russell, when we announced the collaboration between James Patterson and Michael Crichton, within a few days, Mauna Loa percolated. And I was I'm actually scared because now I'm like, no, this is real. Like, he was such a prolific thinker in the future that I think this was time for this to come out.
Sherry Crichton, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Russell.
That was Sherry Crichton, widow of the popular author Michael Crichton, talking to HR's Russell Subiono. Crichton's new novel, set on the Big Island, titled Eruption, is released today. You can find it online in all major booksellers. Thank you. Well, that is it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about Honolulu Magazine's Book Awards to celebrate the incredible talent of our local authors. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or just check our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.